95 FM The Hawk from Mohawk College in Hamilton, Ontario.
You are listening to Bridging the Social Distance. My name is Jenny Mitchell, and I recorded this show here at CFRU, Guelph's campus and community radio station, as a means of creating a platform for us to share ideas and feelings and perspectives in the wake of this global pandemic that is COVID-19. I was afraid that people would get isolated or I would lose the opportunity to chat with my community and find out how everyone is doing, so I made this show. If you're listening and you would like to get involved or be interviewed, you can contact me at mobile@cfru.ca. I'd like to provide the disclaimer that these interviews were recorded at different points in time, so situations in some of these locations may have changed. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Dustin Seabrook, who coordinates Project Isolation, a video documentation of people's personal accounts as they navigate their way through the COVID-19 pandemic. This interview was originally recorded on August 3rd, 2020. To start with, could you introduce yourself for listeners?
My name is Dustin Seabrook. I'm a video or filmmaker and musician producer living in Woodstock, Ontario at the moment. Recently, I've been working on a project, a community-based project called Project Isolation. It's a mini docu-series that is made by participants and local musicians and producers to make mini documentaries about what it's like living amongst the pandemic.
So can I ask when you kicked that off? I guess maybe when you announced it and when you started receiving applications or submissions?
It was right near the beginning, because I was looking at, you know, when everything was unfolding, I think the third week of March, and we were getting more and more information about what we were facing, a lot of the work that I had lined up for the summer was really just like, there was complete uncertainty across the board, and some were even canceled almost immediately. So I was thinking that, you know, this is, as far as work and whatnot goes, everything's going to be gone because of this. And which prompted me to start thinking about like all of the other people that would be experiencing this as well as people experiencing maybe isolation for the first time in their lives, you know, that they don't really have much control over. So I started to think about ways that I could use my skills and making film and whatnot and make it more community-based, where people who don't make film or don't have a lot of creative outlets could be involved in the process. And so I came up with the idea of Project Isolation, which was, at first I wanted to do something with musicians collaboratively and other filmmakers, but I was like, that's really, leaves a whole group of people out that normally wouldn't be involved in something like this that are going to be looking for ways to express themselves as well. And with that in mind, I started to think, well, maybe I could collect people's videos and get accounts of how they're dealing and coping with this new experience that we're all facing together. And within, I think it all happened really quickly. Within a few days, I made a little call for submissions video in my basement and put it online. And within that day, even the next day, I started to get some positive feedback about it and even got a submission within the first 2 or 3 days. So it all happened pretty quickly in that first week of it all.
I want to, I guess, acknowledge or congratulate, or I was really impressed with how quickly you kind of hit the ground running with your project. I really related. I mean, I did this radio show podcast, and it's not dissimilar. I think in my case, I get to lean into the fact that as a host, I can sort of bring people along for the conversation, even if they're not feeling totally capable of being independent and sharing. I'm curious, like, how involved you've had to be when you reach out to people or when they reach out to you. Like, do you need to sort of support them as a filmmaker, or are they kind of truly sending things as they shoot it, sort of unedited, kind of tampered with by you? Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I do anyway. But I guess based on that, 90% of all the submissions I got, people just went with it. you know, my only request was that they filmed in landscape or 16:9 ratio so that I had some consistency across. The very first one, I did have a little bit of back and forth with a couple people because they were the very first ones and they were just looking for some reassurance and, you know, is there a specific topic, you know, questions like that. Do I need to do this for you? You know, questions just on uncertainty in how to go about it themselves. But I think doing that with the first few participants who I'm immensely indebted to for taking the risk and being vulnerable, by doing that, I was able to get the first one out pretty quickly. And I think that set the stage for all the other participants. They could actually see it happening and get an idea of where it's going. Now, I try to encourage that you can say anything you want. You can film anything you want. You know, there was the reality of me interpreting it as best I can and trying to create a story with other people's submissions as well. If there was similar content or similar issues or whatnot, I would try and piece it together so it wasn't just all over the place. My third episode wasn't as successful as the first two in that. It was a little bit more glued together with person to person without anything really tying them together. But for the most part, yeah, people really surprised me in how intuitive they were with both filming and capturing their story. It's been really great.
I'm not altogether familiar with like the range of projects you've kind of overseen. And I'm not sure if you're used to working with, I guess, so-called air quotes, regular people, as opposed to people who kind of come in with the trade already or like are used to being filmed. Was this sort of a learning curve in that regard, or is this something that you actually kind of have some background in?
A learning curve, 100%. Yeah. I've always been what I would consider myself as being a support to other artists, auxiliary, however you want to look at it, backing up people. Until film, I mean, I've done some music and music production as a solo thing or an artist, but for the most part, I've always just, there's always other leaders around. And I learned from them, absolutely. But this whole experience has been, film in general, I think, is what really turned me into somebody who has to direct and lead a bit, which, as I was saying, wasn't really an experience I had before. And this project was a whole other level because of thing, you know, not being able to have meetings with people or be working with them or filming, because that was the first step when I got into film. Is when I go work with people, they're not necessarily, you know, are in the film business or do anything creative or music wise. So there's a bit of that learning curve with any film set, you know, if you're documentary filmmaking, whatever it may be, there are people that have never been in front of camera before. So there's a lot of new things within that. That did carry over to this project, but the fact that, you know, it was so open and people were able to do pretty much whatever they wanted. There was some new experiences and some new challenges, but I think we fared them all pretty well.
Yeah, I've often found, like, I work in community radio, and there's sort of a backbone or a structure or mission there for the so-called regular voice to have a platform. So I feel like I don't ever really have to explain as deeply like what I'm going for, because I sort of get to gesture to a genre as a whole. I can sort of, you know, look to hundreds of examples of regular people having a voice and sharing stories, so people kind of can get it. Yeah, I'm so curious about how you, I guess, like how you convinced people, but or how they convinced themselves to share.
Yeah,
and especially when it's like kind of unprecedented. Like, I imagine the first people to share in particular, when they didn't even have another version of your show to look to, I don't know how they could talk themselves into opening up and being vulnerable and knowing that that's okay.
It's been amazing. To be honest, I was really surprised at the willingness and, as I was saying earlier, just the overall intuitiveness that so many participants had, you know. And it's it's really brave to be able to come out and talk about the not so comforting things or the not so great things about it. And I've done my best to, you know, I had to do some editing, but for the most part, I really tried to keep people's stories as they were, because I think that's important and was important in doing this. This is just a way of us all being together, even though we're going to be apart, and, you know, and know that you're not the only person that's thinking or feeling that way or is insecure about, you know, a certain aspect of what this all means, you know, whether that's financial or caretaking or what does it mean for your future? Those are all really scary things for a lot of us, if not all, you know, everybody, to some extent, and they don't always get shared so candidly, in my experience and life. So to see people so willing to come out and see the good in the cause. And I think, again, that first episode really helped in setting a bit of a tone that, you know, it is okay, as was being said for a while, it's okay to not be okay as well. And yeah, I think that was really, really important in giving people a bit of a taste of what it could be or can be. And then honestly, there wasn't much prompting otherwise on my part. People just took off with it. And it's really impressive.
I think one of the sort of first, I think I can remember two specific things that were my biggest motivators out of the gates to be collecting stories right now. And one was when the caremongering Guelph site popped up on Facebook and people were posting offers of support. And a lot of them were like, I've got a car, or I can pick things up for you, or like a lot of, food sharing or delivery things. And I got suddenly very overwhelmed with like a desire to support, but not wanting to be car number 25 that really wasn't needed, and tried to think of something I could do that wasn't already on that list. And so talking to people was kind of like the thing I leaned into. And then the other part was I have a constant driving obsession for archiving sort of like people's perspectives and feelings right now to later be, I guess, like a people's history. Like at some point it will be history, and I want us to have captured it somehow. I say this because I want to know like what your burning ones were. I know that there was maybe the literal kind of like you saw jobs drying up and had a curiosity around that or your own anxieties around that. But do you remember kind of like the first feelings around the inspiration for the project?
Yeah, for me, I don't know how to exactly put it other than how it is. I love the idea of bringing people together. And I was in a similar place where I often feel this, even pandemic aside, where I don't feel like I have a lot to give back to society or a role at times, which is probably more of my own internal narratives than truth, but I often feel that way. And so there was an urge to be able to use something that I was capable of. Like when the idea came along, it felt really good to have the prospect of bringing some people together. And for me, it wasn't so much like doing something that's already been done, like, you know, be car 22 or whatever, but I'm living in Woodstock and I don't have a huge network around me, so I'm already somewhat isolated. Like that might be going a little far in comparison to what we've been facing, but I don't have a lot of interaction with people in the physical world anyway here, other than a few. So I don't know, there was a bit of an understanding of what that means to be isolated, and I'd already developed some skills and techniques, and I thought, here's an opportunity where I can use some of the skills I've developed over the years to try and do something and give people a voice and make them feel connected. And that was really the driving force behind all of it. And it was more of a hindsight reality that this was part of a documentation of sorts of, you know, history being documented for the future, which I think is, you know, really important in any medium, you know, the show that you're doing. And now looking at Project Isolation and revisiting just recently some of the first episodes, you can feel the difference already in it. And yeah, I think it's more important than when I first set out, I think, to have documented this.
Yeah. I think that's so such an interesting observation because, yeah, when I first started recording, I remember this kind of weird panic of there's no way I can record enough people quickly enough to capture this while it's still happening, and realized how completely absurd that was as a concern, because if we were lucky enough to have the pandemic pass so quickly that we all settled back in and we were fine, then there would be nothing to capture. So it was kind of a weird paranoia, but I also found I could not believe how quickly the types of concerns or the ways they were shared changed. Like, it was almost daily that the way that people's anxiety or the things they were wondering about or the things that they listed as kind of their biggest concerns, or I had a running series of questions. One was like, what could support look like? And one was about silver linings. And it changed so quickly as some of the people, earliest people's like ideas of support became implemented in some ways, and then support changed. And so what are some of the things you observed that really that changed quickly from like the first series to the ones you received after?
I think maybe it's to do with some sort of human will or not being comfortable with not being okay, or I really don't know why it changed so much, but it didn't take long, as you're saying. And by some of the submissions by April, we're talking a month later, you could see the resilience in people. So, I mean, it's positive as well. Some of it I felt like may have been trying to see the silver lining and everything. I found like the first submissions were very raw and there was uncertainty and fear. And I identified with some of it, and it was easier to work with. But then I noticed it didn't take too long, as I was saying, April or so, where you started getting this, you know, yeah, it's crazy, but I think I'm doing great. You know, like this need for positivity, or this to gain control again, maybe, I was chalking it up to. Whether it's authentic or not, I don't know every time, but you know, you have to believe that people are giving you their truths and whatnot. And I mean, there are both sides. Like, a lot of it sure was scary and uncertain, but maybe some people thrive in these sort of situations, you know?
Yeah, it's possible.
It's possible. Yeah. But yeah, I that's sort of I think there was a bit of, you know, the initial shock and not knowing. And then as we settled into this a bit, some things didn't change for some people as much. Yeah, there was differences in how they had to maybe behave in society and be conscious of rules and things that are needed to keep us all a little bit more safe. But yeah, I was shocked at how quickly some submissions just turned into like, things are good, you know? Or some people even enjoyed it to some extent. You know, I'm sure that overall nobody would wish for any of this to happen because there's been a lot of devastation. But I can identify with that things had slowed down to a pace that was a little bit more manageable for someone like myself. And I think a bunch of other people felt similarly that, you know, a bit of that slow pace was, you know, almost welcomed.
Yeah. I'm curious if there are any prompts or structure. Like, one thing that's striking me as you're describing the project, and when I think about the project, is even though you definitely influence it and like you edit after and piece it together, so there's you in it for sure. But, you know, if I'm talking to somebody and I'm curious about why they're feeling the way they're feeling, I kind of in real time get to dive into that, you know, when it's doesn't seem insensitive to do that. And I get kind of to answer some of my questions or we get to work through our curiosities together. And
yeah,
I wonder, like, with people participating with yours, if, I don't know, it feels like you would get a bunch of stuff and wonder about the root of those feelings and not be able to sort of talk with that person about where that came from. And I'm also curious if, like, there's a draw for people to share with you because they really need an outlet for feelings that isn't being interacted with, that they can pour into. But I could also see a motivation for people wanting to, like, utilize your platform to be like, this stuff works really well, in case it's encouraging for someone else to hear. Yeah. So, like, I don't know. I don't know your feelings about any of that, but...
Well, that is part of the call for submissions at the beginning. Part of it was to even, you know, prompting a bit and a little bit of directing was, you know, if you found ways of coping or you're dealing with things a certain way and it's working for you, you know, by sharing that with everybody else, you may help another person by them viewing and seeing what was going on. But yes, to answer the first part of that, there's been times it's really hard to navigate what's appropriate and what's not as far as discussing people's entries and going back, because there isn't that option to do it in real time, say like a radio show or a conversation. So I guess my point is to try and, you know, email them back and be like, you know, and I have with people that I feel a little more comfortable doing that with, but, you know, I don't, unless it's been emailed to me, some sort of opening of dialogue for us to continue talking about their submission and their topic, you know, I don't know if it's really my place to be reaching out to people after the fact. So I've been trying to be respectful of people's privacy and space that way and be like, you know, they've given me what they want to give me. There is some challenges in, and I didn't really take this into consideration so much when I started, especially because I didn't know how vulnerable people's takes were going to be and how personal they were going to be, that there was a heaviness for me in watching some of these, because I'm a fairly sensitive person. And when I am watching these videos and seeing people in distress and uncertainty or whatever, I really feel for them. So that got a little bit weighing at times, and not knowing what to do to support them outside of this project other than to try and represent them as best as I possibly could. So that, yeah, there was challenges around that and not being able to communicate any further. And really, I don't even know if any of my participants found that difficult. I think it'll be a hindsight discussion with some of them afterwards of, like, you know, after you sent that in and in the state of things out there and how you were feeling, looking back on it, whether, you know, did it fill a need for you? Did it give you an outlet, you know, as you were saying, to share your story? Like, did that help as a means of support? Do you have any, you know, not necessarily regrets, but things you wish you hadn't done? You know, I don't really know a lot of that as of yet.
Yeah, the idea of regrets is very interesting, because even in, like, outside of pandemic or any of this, on occasion I interview somebody and they have, like, a tiny bit of interviewer, I don't want to call it remorse, but even a week later, they might be like, you know, you caught me on a really stressful day, and I feel like I sound so much more overwhelmed and upset or angry or short-tempered than I normally do. And I'm often feel like that's magical, that I caught a real raw human moment as it landed, as opposed to everybody only ever being at their best and at their most prepared. But it does strike me that, yeah, there will be all kinds of content in your submissions or on my show that people might not want to revisit ever because they don't identify with it anymore. Maybe they don't even really believe that was them.
Absolutely. And, yeah. I mean, that goes into a whole other level of, you know, the psychology of all of this and stuff way beyond my education, but how people will interpret themselves and things afterwards, it's really, really hard to know. And there is some risk in doing this kind of work for that. And I mean, I can relate to it. I have some difficulties with even interviews or anything. And there's always some remorse because I didn't articulate, you know, myself the way that I wanted to, or I wasn't my authentic self because of, I guess, fear and vulnerability. And I think that's kind of along the lines of what you're saying, is capturing people in these vulnerable states is really powerful and really connecting. But even I know that, I know that and love that, and that it's important for my project to work, I also can identify or empathize with how difficult it can be to be the sort of the subject matter. Mm-hmm. I suppose, you know, to be the person that's being vulnerable, you know, like for me to edit other people and try to do the best for them and represent them as best as I can. That's a lot easier position in some ways, even though I found it heavy at times, than to be the person that, you know, gave themselves for that. So I think it's, again, I can't help but say it's incredibly brave for people who are willing to be open and share when they're not at their best and whatnot, because it's incredibly difficult, or it can be.
Yeah, I remember reading an article quite early on that was like, we should be prepared for the biggest gaslighting of our lives. And the article was around how, like, big business and corporations and all of these sort of bodies that were kind of losing some of their power and some of their position during the quarantine would be fighting very quickly to try to convince us on the other side that we should really go back to exactly how things were, and we really liked it better that way. And it was a curious article because it made me think about the gaslighting we would be doing to ourselves.
Yes.
Because I, you know, the number of times I've written a song or written a diary entry or something like that and then read it and been like, no, but I obviously wrote the thing. But if I can't even accept in a small way some of the feelings I or feel like I'm not entitled to them, or I dismiss them because I have that, you know, other people have it worse. Yeah. It really did strike me that everybody's impulse would be to make light of or try to kind of shrink the actual weight and trauma of this time, and almost just as like a built-in survival strategy. You know,
I was just thinking that as you're saying it, that the idea of almost self-censoring is so ingrained in, I know, even within myself, even having this conversation with you now, there's parts where I'm really thinking about how I want to put it. You know, I'm trying to be as open and as authentic as possible as well, but it's so deeply ingrained in me from growing up and our society to really watch, you know, how vulnerable I'm going to be here or any situation. It's not even, and I'm conscious of it and struggle with both sides of it all the time. So let alone people who don't really acknowledge that they're self-censoring or don't understand that they might be. Yeah, I think it's a huge problem for a lot of us, or for our society in ways of like connecting.
Yeah,
a bit more is if we're always censoring what we share in ourselves, then we're never going to connect, and probably those real connecting moments that are probably not the prettiest parts of being humans. And you and I, like, I mean, I don't want to speak for you, but we have potentially a bit more practice with trying something vulnerable, like a song or, you know, a journal entry, whatever it may be, and still being able to share it with a group of people as a means of connecting, but have already felt the, like, the success of it, as well as the, like, essentially the feelings of rejection or, you know, things not working out. So having practice, it's still difficult. So again, for people who are just doing anything for the first time in that sort of light, including these video submissions, it's commendable, and it can be very scary. So good on anybody who can open up.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That I had not even really thought about the role of the other side of vulnerability, like after you've shared and then it's been either, you know, not so bad or even celebrated or congratulated, and versus people who they haven't gotten to see another side yet. That is that's so interesting. I'm constantly trying to think of like the privilege I bring in to any kind of conversation during this time, you know, to not instinctively try to help or fix or suggest solutions for problems solved. But
that goes back into the responding just as quickly on that going to following up with people after they've given submissions. It's not necessarily my place to be that kind of support for them. They may already have it, it's not really warranted, and it would be me kind of going out of what I think would be appropriate unless it's been invited.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. I definitely respect the need for,
You're listening to Bridging the Social Distance, a show recorded here in Guelph at CFRU as a platform for sharing stories and perspectives during the global pandemic of COVID-19. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Dustin Seabrook, who's been coordinating Project Isolation, a video documentation of people's personal accounts as they navigate their way through the COVID-19 pandemic.
I do want to know more about what you've learned, because I can't help but feel like that has to have been an outcome from this, whether or not it was an intention with this. And absolutely, for me, I remember at some point a few months in saying to someone that I actually started to feel like if I did enough interviewing, I'd have the answers. Like, I've never felt like that with an interviewing project before. It's always opened more questions than answers. But I started to feel like if there was this big puzzle that we were supposed to solve during the pandemic so that on the other side, we were building something with kind of an intention, I think it might have just been me going like a little bit extra crazy, as one maybe does during a pandemic. But it was kind of fascinating. I felt like I was piecing together perspectives on the world that I had never considered, like over and over. And I want to know some of those moments for you, if that was also something you experienced.
How am I going to go about? So, I mean, just in general of learning. There was learning on all different levels with every episode so far and every submission. I think one of the biggest takeaways for me in the sense of filmmaking and people in general is that you don't need, there's almost a story everywhere, I guess, is if I was to really break it down. With filmmaking, there's a lot of times you want to get into really beautiful cinematography and you'll put in all this time and effort into production aspects. And I mean, I love to run and gun a lot and source light that's actually there. That's a bit technical going into that. But I guess my point is that there's such a focus on those things sometimes that it takes away from the story. And I didn't set out to be a documentary filmmaker. This is something that's sort of developed over time, and I wouldn't want to only make documentary film, but in doing this and it kind of falling on me so naturally, not me making the films, but the experience and asking for people to come in, the big takeaway is definitely just that there's a story everywhere and you can tell a good story with very little technical equipment. For anybody who wants to tell an important story of any sort, you can do it with pretty minimal equipment and a little bit of experience, a little bit of help. But I think that was huge for me to take, because I'm so used to being in control of filming and using certain equipment and my camera or whatever, and to piece together videos from all different sources and from all different skill levels, it had its challenges, but if the story is there, it can carry better than some of the most beautiful shots.
Well,
a big thing to learn.
That has prompted a question for me that I'm recognizing another parallel that is kind of neat. So in community radio, one of the driving factors for me, because I specifically am like the mobile studio coordinator too, so a CFRU focused project that is about making studios like in alternative spaces and radio available to people that have additional barriers for whatever reasons. And what I imagine in my mind is like every time a real kind of community voice takes to the airwaves that wasn't there before, it's reclaiming the airwaves from how that very same medium has often been used to manipulate, or it's like an overwhelming amount of content that looks a very specific and very calculated way, like funded privately or funded by a for-profit business. And I'm curious if, like it strikes me that the way you're filming right now is possibly doing the similar kind of thing. Like, it's reclaiming the form to kind of answer to or even fight back against people who have maybe utilized film to tell very specific calculated things, you know?
Yeah. I don't know how well I'll be able to answer that. That's a,
I'm not sure I'm even asking questions at this point. They're all just kind of...
or converse with that. I mean, it just makes me curious about that a bit more and exploring it a bit more because, you know, even as an editor of this content, I am trying to develop certain themes. So I definitely take on some of the storytelling, you know, I'm manipulating it to a certain extent. So far, I haven't had any complaints about the direction I go. And I think I'm really, in essence, trying to grab the best moments and what people are feeling and represent them properly. You know, I'm redundant with that, but it is very important. But it does make me, makes me a bit more curious about people doing more of this independent filmmaking in a sense, right? Everybody was being a bit of a filmmaker there and had a voice, and they directed by what they said with no prompting. They directed the which direction the film was going to go by doing so. You know, there's no script, there's no budgetary factors and, you know, location and all the things that go into even the most, the smallest productions for promo or doc making or anything. There's always some sort of story. There's always some narrative. There's direction. So this being more of an open platform, it is interesting. And maybe I'd like to explore it more. Hopefully others do as well. But this idea of taking a vast subject like a pandemic and just being like, okay, go for it. You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if my hunches are correct about sort of the history of utilizing things like radio and film and any media source to kind of pitch history in favor of particular narratives, like that's traditionally what's been done. Like, growing up, I thought I didn't even like history, and as an adult and starting to like really be interested in stories, I realized I just didn't like when one power dynamic or one positionality gets to retell the story and leave out as many details as they want. And so I think we haven't even seen the other side of this to see whether or not people in those positions do take these forms and start to try to retell the story. And I think that that's traditionally what has happened. And if people like you and I hit the ground running with, you know, publicly sharing real perspectives and real feelings, it feels like that's going to be the counter to that. Or even it may even prevent that from getting any real traction in the first place, which would be incredible.
So, yeah, I mean, it's super important. And I think there's evidence in the world right now of how important those ideas are of getting the stories from the sources of the real people and being conscious of what the stories are that you're being told, you know, what's who else is involved and what's their story and what's being left out and what interests are there. And this kind of documenting based on radio, film, or anything, if you're giving people their own platforms to do it and they're just helping them collect their voice into something that might get seen a bit more, then I think that's potentially way more powerful than I had even considered when I started this project as well.
Yeah, I think it's going to be super important.
Yeah.
It's ironic because it could be one of those things where if it's done right, we'll never see how bad it could have been, which I think is also interesting. You always kind of have to, you know, anytime you've made someone's day better, you don't get the benefit of knowing how bad their day was going to be otherwise. Like, so
yeah.
There is sort of an interesting situation when I think when you're living in the present and doing this kind of work that you may never get to know what it meant or how it changed what otherwise would have been, right?
Yeah, I think that's an important perspective. And just, yeah, there's something about that that I'll never know. And I'm, you know, as you're saying, and that's okay. I don't know. It's all just so new, you know. It takes time to even think about what a style of filmmaking is doing and if it's something that continues on and how important it may or may not be. I mean, I'm in the process of learning about it and myself and other people while doing it. It's all real time. Mm-hmm. So the hindsight hasn't set in, you know.
Yeah. Well, one thing I noticed early on when kind of, not even intentionally, but kind of mapping who was connecting with me, who was I reaching, and they were doing a lot of really like prolific or, you know, a surprising amount of creative work or work at all. And then who was I reaching who really was in a tough place and struggling? And one really consistent factor I found was if you had a job that continued or if you were supported, then those were the folks who kind of hit the ground running a little bit quicker, mm-hmm. And or had more offers of support or output than they did requiring or requesting support. And so I very quickly felt like after I talked to, I think for maybe 1 week's of interviews is when I went online and posted, by the way, this is something I'm observing. So if you see me and you see I'm doing stuff, please know how much privilege I have that I have a job, I am supported, and that's why I felt like I could do something right away. And if you're someone who is not there yet, you don't know where support's going to come from, like, please understand I really, really, like, don't compare yourself to me. That would be so dangerous and not helpful to anyone. And the thing about you is I don't, when you describe that, you know, you saw all these projects drying up, you saw that business was going to cease, you still kind of hit the ground running. And that's kind of the first example of almost like the opposite of what I saw. Like, I don't know. Did you have support that I'm not seeing that like was integral to you being able to like shoulder this project? Or
yeah,
I don't know.
I mean, I have support in my living dynamics right now where my rent is a lot lower than a lot of other people's, which gives me an opportunity to work on some creatives and things. And even with the pandemic, I knew I was going to be okay for at least a short while, which maybe freed up some of the stress that others might have. But I, in all honesty, the whole project was immediately, I felt like there was maybe an opportunity to work with people and connect with people. I think that's something that I feel it lacks in our society and has been a struggle for me for most of my adult life and even longer. And I just immediately had some empathy for people who wouldn't have outlets and know what to do. And luckily that part of myself and who I am gave me the idea to do this quickly. And I think that's all it really came from. Mm-hmm. I was just kind of having, you know, brainstorming about what can I do now? You know, like, I want to be creative. I have the means. I've set up a little bit of a, you know, it's taken me 20 years to do it, but a little bit of a home studio situation where I can create content and music and do film and do editing and all these things that I'm trying to develop a business with. But I'm like, if the business side's not happening, it's still something I can do. And I'm also very privileged and grateful to be able to be creative because I recognize that people don't all have either the means of doing it or haven't really explored it or had that confidence to explore it yet or are just in a situation potentially financially or whatever it may be where resources are limited for them. You know, like, I'm not well off by any means and have a lot of sacrifices. I mean, I love wealth. I would even love to live in wealth, but I can't afford wealth. So that puts, in order to do what I'm doing or want to do, that puts me living in a different place in order to do it. So there are some sacrifices there, but overall, I'm pretty lucky, you know, I guess with the resources that I have to work with, the support I have around me. I do have a very supportive and caring group of family and friends that more or less are like, if you're doing work that you feel is important and you're able to live and breathe on this planet content enough, then that's good enough for them.
Yeah.
So that's been helpful. But again, I realize the privilege in that too. So yeah, I think hitting the ground running was really just came from a place of trying to fill some sort of gap that I kind of perceived would be coming, if not already right there.
Yeah, fair enough. I relate to that in a really big way. Like, I don't know that you and I would identify, you know, as equally extroverted, but I'm extremely extroverted and did anticipate that, yeah, any kind of void in connecting was going to be extremely difficult for me, and that really if I could find a helpful way to also be satisfying that piece, that would put me in a stronger position to be able to support anyone else I need to. And so, yeah, there's so much to be said for being, I guess, self-aware enough of your own patterns to know what you're going to need, but how to turn it into a tool or a resource instead of just a self-serving thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, self-awareness is a double-edged sword. Yeah. In some ways, it can be incredibly difficult and painful, but I am also lucky for that. But yeah, I would definitely identify more as introverted and need extrovert moments. And I think that was part of the motivation in this too, is that when it first happened, of course, there was things I was uncertain about and afraid of and whatnot. But there was a big part of me that's like, alone for months? No problem. I'm well-versed in this, practiced, you know? But I also agree that in saying that, we're a social species. Even the most introverted of people often, you know, I'm not blanketing absolutely everybody, but most people need some sort of social connection of some level. Mm-hmm. And I think one of my considerations was how many people would be extroverted or are extroverted and rely on workplace and family dynamics and things of that nature. They rely on that for their comfort and their sanity even. And I was thinking, all of these people are going to be, you know, the world's gonna be turned upside down, like people who just took kind of being an extrovert for granted. And I want to go somewhere, I can go somewhere. If there's a show happening every day of the week, I can go. I can go to school, I can go to work, all of these things that we've taken for granted. I was like, I have a feeling that some of these people are going to be really lost and potentially scared. And facing something that they've maybe never really experienced before. I mean, I'm not, because confidentiality and whatnot, I have friends that are close to me that experienced levels of anxiety that they've never experienced before because society worked for them a little bit better. Or somebody like myself, who some of the structures that we have in place make it difficult for me and day-to-day life at times. I actually have a bit of coping skills that I've developed because of years of that actually helped me in this situation more than them, because I was able to use some of those skills I've developed to deal with some of the uncertainties and whatnot. So I really felt for those people. It's like, I couldn't imagine just being dropped into a world that they don't know.
Yeah.
Essentially, with no certainties and no skills to work with any sort of mental health adversity that they might experience. Even if it's temporary, it can be very intense and very, very scary.
Again, yeah, you're bringing up some really just very relatable and important to me points. Absolutely have struggled with anxiety for a long time. But for that reason, I feel like I really didn't suffer during this time the way I've observed a lot of people. I think, I have, like, you know, it's almost like my anxiety has its own identity that I can practically have a conversation with at this point, so we can work things out, you know, on a good day.
That's important. That shows that you're quite skilled in it. I think that's very much how a lot of people who function well with any sort of adversity, or when it comes to mental health or anxieties or whatnot, if you're able to treat it as its own identity in ways. I know that sounds funny, but I think it's important because it does need to be talked to, you know, like what, mm-hmm. what are the issues? What is causing this? What is my body telling me? Mm-hmm. Why, you know, what is causing any sort of fear or doubt? A lot of times stepping back and looking at that information or trying to figure out what it is, it might have some sort of relief, you know, mm-hmm. there might be an answer there.
Mm-hmm.
Not always, but
yeah,
I think it's important.
For sure. And even when there isn't an answer, being used to that is part of it too, right? So
yeah. Like, well, I guess I just go with it. I don't have the answer. So I'm just going to ride this one out, which I know I've experienced not that long ago. Cause like, even for me, I also didn't have much difficulty when it all started. And there was a part of it that was, like I said, there was comfort in things slowing down because I feel like the world moves so fast and I don't fit into that speed all the time, or I get worn out
mm-hmm.
quickly. So there was nice parts about it, but within the last couple months, I also just had a regular bout of anxiety and a bit of depression, but that's unfortunately in some aspects has been like a reality of my life for the last 20 years. So in that time, I have developed a lot of skills and I have some pretty decent support networks around me when that happened. So it wasn't really pandemic related, but it was, you know, here I am again. I kind of look at it and then have that conversation and slow things down. And to be honest, that's sort of I haven't put out an episode in quite some time. And that was part of it, is I needed to take care of my own health. And it was difficult because I know some people were put themselves out there and giving me content. And I'm working with Vanessa Tignanelli and Kimber Sider, who have been really supportive. Like, Vanessa's doing assistant editing and kind of pre-editing things that she's getting on her end. And they're both really gifted in storytelling and film. So, you know, they'll give nice feedback on what I'm doing or things that I could look at differently. Just a different lens and a really professional one, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to put it. Someone experienced, or both of them very experienced. So I'm really grateful for that. But in that, you know, like, they've invested some time and effort into this too. And there's a little bit of that, like, oh, I'm letting people down by not getting these episodes out with my lofty, I think I said something ridiculous like every week at first, and that turned into like every 2 weeks to a month right away. And I was like, it's just impossible. I think I was thinking in my mind it was going to come out a lot easier and that they would just be stitched together on their own, but it does take a lot of editing power. And yeah, the weight of everything, the weight of my own uncertainty, watching these clips, you know, they're heavy. And if you feel stuff, it can get pretty heavy. So all of those things together, I needed to step back and just be like, I need to take care of myself for a bit.
Yeah.
And work on things that I need to work on, and then I'll come back to it. But I'm lucky because I have some of those, that capability now to identify what's going on, take the step back, come back at it when I'm feeling better and have the resources to do it again, you know?
Oh, for sure. As a person who also works in a lot of feelings from time to time when editing, I think the best thing you could do as an editor is make sure you're in the right headspace for it. It's not fair to the material to force it, you know? And so I don't think there's a rush for sharing. I think we're going to need to share for a long time. I think that capturing and recording is very important and maybe is a little time sensitive in a way, but I think the more of it we're doing, the better, and we can share when it feels right, you know?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think that's important too. Just on the it would seem like an opportunity to give some of the reality of my world and why the project has slowed down, because it's not done by any means. I don't, like you said, I don't think this is going to be done for a while. And that might even be included in the tie-up of this, if and when that happens, you know, is that there was a period of time where it affected, you know, my day-to-day and had to take a little bit of a break. You know, that's all part of the story.
Yeah.
I'm not in it per se, but I'm a part of it, so.
Well, we're almost at an hour, and there's a couple of questions I've been asking everybody. The question around what you think support could look like, and curious if, like, in seeing people reach out and share their vulnerabilities and or things you've experienced, if there has been an overarching feeling that, like, we could just be doing this one little thing or something we could do for ourselves or each other during a time like this to help feel supported and or share support.
I think there's a large calling, and it's been really opened up by this pandemic, for looking at universal basic income, especially for people the most vulnerable of our society, those with disabilities and whatnot. I mean, it's close to home for me, but the fact that when CERB came to be, you know, it was really helpful for a lot of people, a lot of independent contractors, gig workers, and whatnot. But it also shined a light on, like, that $2,000 is considered minimum, you know, that people can live off of. And it just had me thinking, like, why is there this large portion of the population that already has more struggles and more difficulties and more costs in some ways, are only seeing, sorry for the noise, around $1,100 a month to survive on, and that doesn't change for them. I think it just shines light on that even a basic support, like, you know, I understand that the money's coming from somewhere, but in the end, it ends up being less expensive for us as a society if people are living with dignity and with support and can build themselves and build their lives. Because there's studies all around the world that are showing how successful and important it is. That's one of them for me, anyway.
I think that's a huge one. I very much agree. So thank you. And thanks for pointing out the sort of discrepancy there, because, yeah, I've seen that too. My other question's around silver linings. And I guess for the purposes of keeping it brief, if there's one thing you've seen during this time that was sort of a bright spot that you'd maybe like to see continued, even if we do kind of get the announcement that we can go back to something like normal. I mean, imagining that we're comfortable with that and we're going back, but something you'd like to see continued.
Well, this will go touch on disability again, but there was a participant in one of the videos that pointed out that with all of the online shows and community concerts or anything of that nature, that everything was accessible online, really shone a light on, for me, especially not having physical disability, how many people are benefiting from being able to see things online and stream. So even if we go back to clubs and bars and festivals and things being open, I really hope that people continue to take into consideration those that can't make it because of physical, mental, emotional barriers, and giving, you know, filming these events so that people can watch them still at home. It was really beautiful to see somebody, how much they lit up and appreciated that had changed for them, and that they hope that it continues to go on, and I can't help but agree that it should be there.
That's awesome. Well, for anyone listening that wants to check out your project, either to submit, if you're still taking submissions, and or see what you have released so far, what are some links that you could share?
I should have a website for this, but the best place to go is to search for Still Creates, STILL space, and then Creates, CREATES. Vimeo has, my Vimeo account has the videos. Also, my Instagram is probably, sadly, one of my best social places for seeing films and getting involved. And that's at Still Creates.
Okay.
Instagram. Yeah, awesome. I don't really have a specific place for it. So.
No, I mean that in this day and age, I think those links will work. Totally. Yeah. Totally. Well, right. I feel we could have talked for ages more because it's so interesting, but I thank you for what we did get to talk about, and I really, really appreciate you making the time and sharing with me today, Dustin.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me on, and we'll talk to you soon.
So once again, that was Dustin Seabrook, who's been coordinating Project Isolation, which acts as a video documentation of people's personal accounts as they navigate their way through the COVID-19 pandemic. If you want to check out what's been released so far or submit to the project, you can go to Still Creates on Vimeo or follow Still Creates on Instagram.
That brings us to the end of this episode of Bridging the Social Distance, a show produced at CFRU in Guelph and syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario, that aims to create a platform for us sharing what we are doing to get through this time together in the wake of COVID-19.